First reading this morning from Genesis chapter 15 starts out in such a lovely, noble, encouraging, fortifying kind of a place. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. The problem is, Abram, or as he will become known, Abraham does not feel sheltered. He doesn't feel rewarded for his life. Abraham has a problem. Abraham feels betrayed by his life. Abraham is, at this point in the story, 86 years old, which, even by Anglican standards, probably qualifies as old age, I would think. And when you get to be 86 years old, there are certain doors in life that have likely closed to you. And one of the doors that had closed to Abraham, he believed, was the door of fathering children. Abraham had carried in his heart for all these many, many long years of his journey through life, which had been at best circuitous and somewhat tumultuous and full of wheeling and dealing and winding pathways. It had not been a straight line from here to there. And all of those years, he'd carried in his heart this promise, this deep promise that God had given him when God said, I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. And yet, here he is, 86 years old, a wife equally aged, and they're childless. And you have to understand, in Abram's day, unlike in our day, in Abram's day, to be childless was a truly shameful thing. It meant insecurity. It meant a life of fear and perhaps poverty. It certainly meant that you lost status in the eyes of your society. Great store was put upon being able to bear children. So Abraham is frustrated. He feels let down by his life. He doubts God, even in the one passage, the short passage we read this morning. He goes back and forth between, oh yeah, God, I believe you. And then he goes, well, wait a minute, what about this? So Abraham has gone back and forth between doubt and faith. He's confused. He feels lost. And in this passage, he hears God tell him to conduct this strange ritual of cutting up animals and burning them. He doesn't know what it means. And actually, Larry's going to explain that to us because nobody knows what it means. Scholars all over the place have poured their hearts into trying to figure out this strange ritual that is present in Genesis chapter 15, and none of them really has come up with a good argument to make sense of it. It's just confusing. Abraham's life seems to have descended to this place at the end of our reading this morning, where the writer tells us, as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abraham, and a deep and terrifying darkness descended upon him. Michael Gerson has reason to believe that his life has been richly blessed. He is the 54-year-old op-ed columnist of the Washington Post, which by any measure of success, I think, rates probably as a success. But Michael Gerson also has reason to feel betrayed, let down, disappointed by his life. He is, he says, like 1 in 10 Americans, a person who lives with what he calls the insidious chronic disease called depression. Last month, February the 17th, Michael Gerson preached at the National Cathedral in Washington. I'm going to read you some bits of that sermon this morning, read you more than I usually would read, but the sermon itself was read, so it works well because it's a beautiful piece of literary writing. He started out by saying, "All of us, whatever our natural serotonin level, look around us and see plenty of reason for doubt, anger, and sadness. A child dies. A woman is abused. A schoolyard becomes a killing field. A typhoon sweeps away the innocent." I suppose if he were speaking this morning, Michael Gerson might have mentioned Paul Najore. Paul Najore is childless today. He comes from Toronto. Last week, he put his wife, Caroline, who's 34, son Ryan, daughter Carrie, who's 4, and baby Ruby, 9 months old, and his mother-in-law on a flight to Nairobi to visit the children's grandparents. It was flight 302. He lost his entire family. Or perhaps Mr. Gerson this morning would have mentioned Christchurch, New Zealand. Perhaps he would have mentioned the horror and the violence. Perhaps he would have mentioned the pain and the suffering of our Muslim brothers and sisters, as again, they're called to bury their dead who did nothing except show up in their place of worship to worship God. Jesus looked down on the city of Jerusalem, and Jesus lamented, "How often, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, would I have gathered you to my breast as a mother hen gathers her chicks." Gerson goes on, "If we knew or felt the whole of human suffering, we would drown in despair. By all objective evidence, we are arrogant animals headed for the extinction that is the way of all things. We imagine that we are like gods and still drop dead like flies on the windowsill." The answer to the temptation of nihilism is not an argument. Though philosophy can clear away a lot of intellectual foolishness, the answer to nihilism is the experience of transcendence we cannot explain or explain away. I think that's the meaning of Abram's strange sacrifice in the middle of Genesis 15. God says, "Here, do something really weird that you are not going to understand. Do something that makes no sense to you whatsoever, because you need to know when you're whining and complaining about being childless, you don't understand anything. You don't know what's going on. When you grieve and your heart breaks because your children are gone, you don't understand what this is about. It doesn't make sense, and it can't make sense, and we shouldn't diminish it or belittle it or make it smaller than it is by pretending for one moment that we can understand Christchurch, New Zealand, or that we can understand Flight 302, or that we can understand the pain and the suffering of our own lives and our own hearts. We can't make sense of those things, and we best not diminish them by pretending that we can. They're just there. They're real, and they're true." And for Abraham, it was like a deep darkness that descended upon him. But Gerson holds out the possibility that in the midst of not understanding, there is the possibility of light, the possibility of hope. He says, it is the fragments of love and meaning that arrive out of the blue in beauty that leaves a lump in your throat, in the peace and ordered complexity of nature, in the shadow and shimmer of a cathedral. Maybe he would have added, in the shimmer of these windows here this morning, had he been preaching here, in the unexplained wonder of existence itself. He goes on, I have one friend, John, who finds God's hidden hand in the habits and coloring of birds. And then he says, my friend Catherine, when her first child was born, discovered what she calls a love much greater than evolution requires. Think about that. A love much greater than evolution required. So what this woman, Catherine, did, she get this baby, and she looks at the baby and she thinks, you know, to look after this baby and to change this baby's diapers and to change and to feed this baby and to listen to this baby cry and to rock this baby and hold this baby and care for this baby and all these things that I'm going to need to do, I'm going to need a love this big. This big. And all of a sudden, what she found in her heart was a love this big. That's a miracle. And that stands in face of all the brokenness and the pain and the suffering and the heartache of life. You know, many years ago, 43 years ago, I met a young woman. And she was cute, and she was beautiful, and she was funny, and she was full of vibrancy and life. And within days, I had a love for her that was this big. But it was okay because there were a few other forces at play at the time in our relationship that drew me to this person. And you know, the reality is, over the years intervening, some of those other forces have kind of tempered a little bit. They haven't died, but they've gentled, they've softened. They're not quite as compelling as they once were. But as those other forces have perhaps a little bit diminished, that love, or my awareness of that love, has grown and grown and grown. And there have been times when, you know, she's behaved in ways that required a love this big to put up with her. And I've put it in a way that required a love as big as this church to put up with me. And it's always been there. It's never stopped. It's never failed. It's never let us down. We've let other distractions cause us sometimes to forget that it's this big. But it's never stopped and never let us down. I wish I could say that Abraham went on to be this grand paragon of faith and trust in God. But you know, even from this point on, his life kind of wandered and he got a little bit astray from time to time. The first thing he did was run out and take his wife's slave woman, Hagar, and bear a child by her. That sounds like a good idea, don't you think? It wasn't a good idea. It led to nothing but chaos, pain, and suffering. Him trying, with his wife's cooperation, to serve and save this vision he had. His life went on from this point to be a mixed bag of continued doubt, scheming, self-interest. And after God's promise, even, he continues to struggle with dark times. You can't gloss over this just with a smile. Michael Gerson goes on to say, at some point, willed cheerfulness fails. Or we skim along the surface of our lives, afraid of what lies in the depths below. It's a way to cope, but no way to live. He He says, I'd urge anyone with undiagnosed depression to seek out professional help. There's no way to will yourself out of this disease any more than to will yourself out of tuberculosis. There are, however, other forms of comfort. Those who hold to the wild hope of a living God can say certain things. In our right minds, as our most sane and solid selves, we know that the appearance of a universe ruled by cruel chaos is a lie, and that the cold void is actually a sheltering sky. In our right minds, we know that life is not a farce, but a pilgrimage, or maybe a farce and a pilgrimage, depending on the day. In our right minds, we know that hope can grow within us like a child. In our right minds, we know that transcendence sparks and crackles all around us in a blinding light and a child's voice and fire and tears and a warmed heart if we open ourselves to seeing it. Fate may do what it wants, but this much is settled. In our right minds, we know that love is at the heart of all things. Many understandably pray for a strength they do not possess, but God's promise is somewhat different, that even when strength fails, there is perseverance. And even when perseverance fails, there is hope. And even when hope fails, there is love, and love never fails. So how do we know this? How can anyone be so confident? Because we are Lazarus, and we live. We are Lazarus. We die every day. We have things to let go of, things to surrender, visions that fall apart, plans that don't work out. And we die every time we let go of one of those. And yet, we live. The blood courses through the veins in our body. Our lungs continue to expand and contract. Our hearts beat. Life is faithful. Life is trustworthy. Life is full of energy and joy, right? And curly heads. Life is full of goodness and beauty. Comes to us as a child. It runs to us. Life embraces us. And our only challenge is never to figure it out, is never to make sense of it. Our challenge is to open it to it and embrace the love and goodness that is our true nature.